Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Today's episode is brought to you by Mahina Offshore Services, the company run by sailing expert and previous podcast guest John Neal. If you're looking to get started with the sailing lifestyle, Mahina Offshore Services offers three fantastic options to help you out. First, they offer ocean sail training expeditions in many locations around the world, where you can learn with John and gain the skills and confidence needed to tackle ocean passages. Second, if you're planning on boat shopping, Mahina Offshore Services also offers boat selection consultation, where John can guide you through the process and help you find the perfect boat for your needs. And finally, the virtual cruising seminar is a fantastic resource that you can enjoy at your own pace from the comfort of your couch. Whether you're a seasoned sailor or just getting started, there is something for everyone in this comprehensive seminar. So visit the website at mahina.com to learn more about these services and get started on your sailing journey. Now, here is what's coming up next on the Liverboard Sailing Podcast.
Well, before that, when you say the whole experience, you mean I put in the bad stuff as well as the good stuff? That would be true. I put in my mistakes because they're my mistakes. I have to live with them. It's just that's part of the adventure. I didn't know what I was doing when I started this boating adventure. I had no boating experience before I bought this boat. The first night I slept on a boat properly was this boat after I bought it.
Welcome to the podcast. I am your host, Annika. On the Liverboard Sailing Podcast, I chat with awesome people who live, work, and travel on their sailboats. My guests share inspiring stories and real-life advice about the lifestyle so that you and I can be better prepared for our sailing adventures. In this week's episode, I sit down with Steve Payne, a Liverboard cruiser and a YouTube creator who has been sailing around Europe for the past few years. I start off by asking Steve the age-old question, why is he living on a boat? And we delve into his journey from being a professional photographer and filmmaker to becoming a YouTube creator in the sailing world. We also explore the joys of Liverboard life and his experience cruising through the French canals. Additionally, we touch on the Friendly Flag project that Steve started that encourages friendship and socialization on the water. So without further ado, let's get started. I like to start the conversation with a question that you must have been asked a million times, and that is why. So Steve, why have you chosen to live on a boat?
I chose to live on a boat because I like travel. I like to have somewhere that feels like home. And those two things weren't really in the same like ballpark. I wanted somewhere to live and I like to travel. And I didn't want to buy a little flat in Slough and then go traveling places because I'd still be living in Slough. So I decided to get the hell out of the UK and travel to the Mediterranean. But I'm like, it feels a little bit like my boat is like a little spaceship. And you're like popping from planet to planet to planet. And you arrive at this new place and you go to the local supermarkets and you go to the local shops and you meet people and you talk to them. And then you go back to your boat and you launch off and you go to the next place. It's a funny life that I really like.
Yeah, I can completely relate to that idea of wanting to travel, but also wanting to have the comfort of a great accommodation always nearby and your home. I personally hate finding Airbnbs and you know, finding the perfect place to stay at or a hotel and changing your location or your accommodation all the time. So that's one of the reasons why the boating lifestyle really appeals to me, because I would love to travel with my own home and move it with me. That's sounds amazing. And then hopefully I'll get to that one day. And certainly don't blame me from going from the UK to the Mediterranean. That seems like a natural course in terms of the climate. But I want to talk a little bit about your professional background, because it's quite interesting. So you've obviously, you said you left England, but before that you spent a lot of time in the United States as well. So can you tell us a little bit more about your professional background and how, I know you are now, have entered the world of YouTube, and I think that's just a fascinating connection how that's played out.
It all does kind of play into itself. I was a professional photographer in London for about 10 years. And I started working for the music newspapers like Melody Maker and Record Mirror, NME. And I ended up working for Sounds. And then you get put into contact with other people. And I slowly moved across to the Evening Standard, which is like London's newspaper. The Evening Standard is a really good newspaper. It still is. And I just worked there. But I also, because I'd started in music and I've always liked music, I was doing like shooting music videos and live concerts and things like that. And then I did a job in California, and we'd had like, I don't know how many years of Thatcher, 12 years of Thatcher. And she'd really beaten the country down. And I did this job in California and everyone was happy and friendly. And I'm like, I like it here. So I pretty much just packed up and moved myself to California. And I ended up living there for the next 27 years. And I loved it. California is great. California is like a country. It's very different from the rest of America. And I really enjoyed my time there. But then my mother, who was at that point 92, needed some care. So I went back to the UK and I took care of her for quite a while. And then like 6 months or so. And then she passed away. And I had the option to either stay in the UK or just get the hell out. And getting the hell out sounded like a lot better of an idea. And so I bought a boat and moved my life onto the boat. And because it's just me on the boat, I think that rather than talk to myself, at least I had, you know, a little camera to talk to. And I started doing this YouTube thing just because talking to a camera doesn't look as weird as talking to myself.
No, and that's great. And I get that feeling from your videos. It feels like, you know, we're having a FaceTime call or something. You're just picking up the camera and just explaining what's going on. And it's perfect. And I can completely understand that when you're by yourself on a boat, that you want to share it with somebody and, you know, explain a little bit what's happening.
Because it's like when I talk to the camera, I talk to it like it's a friend, because I realized this after I've been doing it for a year. Because I always talk about today we're so-and-so, or we're going on this adventure. It's like we, as opposed to I'm going on this adventure and I'm just going to have a camera with me. I'm like, I'm taking you with me and we go somewhere. And it's almost a sort of odd, slightly unique style of, if you watch my videos, you feel like you're there with me on the boat. And I just kind of like it like that, because you are with me on the boat.
Yeah, exactly. You get a great glimpse of what the life is like there on a boat whether it's in France or in the Mediterranean and so on.
But it's odd because the camera that I tend to use is a GoPro, and it's got a wide angle lens. And that there's two reasons for me using that. Three reasons. Rather than have a more expensive camera with an expensive lens that is probably going to at some point go overboard, because I've lost GoPros as well, I decided to use the GoPro because it's got a wide-angle lens. It means the camera has to be closer to me when I shoot with it, which gets better audio. But it also gives you a different perspective of, rather than watching a screen, you're watching a person. Because the camera's close in, it's more intimate. And that was intentional. I meant that to happen. And it's worked out wonderfully. And I can go back and watch my old videos and I still like them. And I'm a very, very harsh critic. And if I didn't like them, I would immediately delete them. I've spent like 2 hours exporting a video, another 2 hours uploading it. And then it renders for another few hours. And I've watched it and I've gone, there's one typo and I don't like that shot. And I've deleted the whole thing and done the whole thing again. It's not that I'm a perfectionist. I'm not. I'm absolutely the opposite of a perfectionist. But if there's something in there that bugs me, I can't live with it and it'll come down. So
yeah, it's interesting. And I wonder if it has something to do with your professional background, because, you know, that kind of thing, you know, you used to look at things more in a professional setting. And this, of course, is just a hobby, in quotation marks. But, you know, it's still, you know, have that mentality, like, you know, it's going out in the world. It's going to be great.
It's going out there, and it's going long after I've departed this planet. Those videos are going to live on. And the fact that I misspelled something in there, that can't happen. So yeah, there is that. And I hope that someone can go through and find some typos in there, because they are there. They just are. It's not a professional thing. It is just a fun thing.
Oh, of course. It tells a journey either way. You know, it documents the whole experience, which is great. But we've talked about all this, you know, time spent on a boat and all that. So what kind of boat do you have?
Well, before that, when you say the whole experience, you mean I put in the bad stuff as well as the good stuff? That would be true. I put in my mistakes because they're my mistakes. I have to live with them. You know, it's just, that's part of the adventure. I didn't know what I was doing when I started this boating adventure. I had no boating experience before I bought this boat. The first night I slept on a boat properly was this boat, the day after I bought it. So that's that. But I bought this boat because it's a Birchwood TS-37. Built in 1987, so it's not a new boat by a long way, and I've had people say, how can you afford to live on a boat? And I'm like, I can afford to live on the boat because I have a boat to live on. You know, it's like someone the other day was like saying, yeah, it must be really expensive. And I'm, how much have you paid in rent over the past year? And they said, well, you know, I paid $1,600 a month. And I'm like, right, that's way more than I've paid. And I live on a boat.
Oh, for sure. It's not as expensive as people maybe make out to be. I'm sure it could be, but
it can be. Yes.
Land living is also expensive.
Yeah, absolutely. It's expensive if you fix everything the moment it doesn't work and you don't learn how to fix some things yourself. You know, it's like I was in, where was I? Vivier in France. And my engine would not start. My starboard engine would just not start. It would turn over. And I'm like, God damn it. I know it's something simple because it's not making it didn't make a horrible noise before it stopped working. And it's not making a bad noise as it's turning over. And I am not a diesel engineer, so I don't really know what the hell I'm doing. And I had a friend back in the UK who I'd met on a Facebook page for Birchwood boat owners, and he actually knew the boat, and he just kept encouraging me to track down the fault. And he wasn't able to pinpoint the fault because he's somewhere back in the UK, but he kept encouraging me to find it, you know, just do this, and maybe you could try that. And eventually I found the fault, which was one tiny little wire that got corroded down in the engine room. And when I took off this big box with all these wires in it, and I'm like, and then I started wiggling them around, and one just came loose. And I'm like, I instinctively knew that was the problem. And I connected it back up, and I went upstairs and I turned the engine on and it started perfectly. So I'm like, I was very proud of that moment.
Oh, for sure. It takes some detective work to try to find out what's not working. And I talk to a lot of people and it's always something small. It's never something big and obvious. The engine blows up or anything. It's just a tiny little thing that takes hours to find.
Yeah, diesel engines are interesting because once they're running, they actually don't require any electricity. They're kind of bomb-proof because they don't have spark plugs and an ignition system. They have a glow plug, and once they go, they go. But this one wire was part of the cutoff system when you want to turn it off, and that's what's causing the problem. But yeah, diesel engines, I mean, the boat isn't as green as I would like it, but I don't have a car and I'm just on my boat. So I don't know, I have to live with that burden.
You do have solar paddles there though, right?
I do. I have a large solar panel that I installed myself. And like right now, for example, we are actually being powered by the sun because I'm on my computer and it's working off the solar panels, which are charging at 13.6 volts. And I've got 410 ampere hour batteries downstairs in the engine room that are separate from the boat engine. I've got another 410 ampere hours, but they run the boat, and I keep both systems separate because you that's just what you do. You keep your solar away from the power. I can charge the boat batteries with solar if I need to, but I tend not to. I keep away from that.
How long is the boat?
It is 11.3 meters, and it is 3.8 wide, and it has a draft of 1.2 or something like that, I think.
Oh, yeah, which makes sense. Well, we'll talk about the French canals in a little bit. But first, I wanted to see, you've been, you know, living on your boat now for a couple of years, I think. So what is it that brings you joy in this lifestyle? What have you found that is something that keeps you wanting to keep going?
You know how if you live somewhere, I mean, I'm freelance. So all of my life, I've been freelance all my life. I've never quite known where the next rent check was coming from. I've had to earn it. It's like I didn't just have a job where I knew that whatever I did, I was going to get paid. And so the fact that I don't have to worry about that rent check every month, that, I swear, has probably added years to my life. I don't have to worry. I have very little stress on the boat. I've got very low stress level. I've worked in production, so I know what stress is like when, you know, it's like you've got to get the shot, and you've got to do this and you've got to do that, or you're not coming back to work the next day. So my stress levels are very low, and I really do appreciate that.
Yeah, that's a great goal to have.
Yeah, I did have a, I don't know if I'd call it stressful night. Yeah, it was stressful night the other night, where a bunch of stuff happened where I had set my destination. When I got there, I realized that it wasn't deep enough. And even though there's only like, I don't know, 300 millimeters of tide in this part of the Mediterranean, it wasn't going to be good. So I decided not to go into that mooring spot. And I had to go to the next one that I had, because you always got to have a plan B. And I started motoring the boat on, and it was getting dark, and I pulled into the next spot. I checked the weather, it was going to be good, and I went to sleep quite early, like 8 o'clock, and by 10:30, 11 o'clock, the boat had started rocking, and I'm like, oh, it shouldn't be rocking this much. And then it started rocking and rolling more and more and more, and it just got to the point at which it had never, I'd never anchored in waves as big as that before. They ended up going from about 0.2 of a meter to about 1.2 of a meter, which doesn't sound much, but this is a motorboat. It's very different from a sailing boat. So it does not handle rough water as well as a sailing boat does. And I was all over the place. And then I started feeling a bit seasick, and I don't get seasick. And then I was watching some video that I'd shot that day, and I realized that I had eaten some salmon, and I got a feeling I ate the wrong pack of salmon that was past its due date, and I got food poisoning. And food poisoning is just horrible, because it's like getting whacked on the back of a head by a 2x4. And you're just, I was hallucinating almost. I felt like there was someone else on the boat, and I was in this weird kind of dream state. And luckily the anchor held, even though the boat was bucking up and down, the anchor held, and it was just miserable, as opposed to being miserable and dangerous. Because if the anchor had started to drag, and I have dragged an anchor before, but if the anchor had started to drag, it would have dragged me towards the coast. And I was only maybe 200, 100 meters away from rocks. And I would have had to go out onto the foredeck of the boat when it was bucking up and down to raise the anchor. And I didn't feel safe doing that. And even if I had gone up there and been able to raise the anchor, I had nowhere to go, you know, because it was dark and it was only going to get worse if I'd taken the boat out to sea. I didn't know what I was going to do if I had to raise the anchor. But fortunately, I didn't have to raise the anchor. I just sat there and grinned and bared it and waited till the dawn, and then I moved on and went to a safe harbor for a few hours and just crashed out, because that was a miserable night. It was just horrible. But
that was the only slightly stressful thing.
yeah. Seasickness plus food poisoning, plus the boat bouncing around like it had never bounced around before. So that was not a pleasant evening.
No, I can imagine it was not. And that was obviously on the Mediterranean side. But let's talk about the little bit of a calmer waters of the French canals, because I find that idea really fascinating. I know there's a lot of bike routes that crisscross France and along the canals, but of course you can do them on a boat as well. So I would love for you to tell me a little bit about your route through France, as obviously you cross the English Channel. And then what?
I can't remember when I figured out that you could take a boat all the way through France to the Mediterranean, but I'm sure one afternoon I was just sitting drinking a cold beer somewhere on my boat, and I'm like, holy shit, you can take a boat all the way through France? Because originally I think I was planning on going around the coast, but I'm like, that would be amazing. And when I bought this boat, I was lucky. I was looking at different boats, and I found a boat that I really liked the look of. It was a Dutch steel cruiser, and it had a single 145 horsepower motor in it. And I went and took it for a little sea trial, a river trial, and it was smoking more than it should have done. And then when we pulled back into the marina, the sales guy was in charge, and he was running the boat, and he went to put it into reverse, and it wouldn't go into reverse, and we almost crashed into the pontoon. And I kind of looked at him, and he looked at me, and I went, I just shook my head, and he goes, no, you shouldn't be buying this boat. So I backed off that one. And as I said, it was a beautiful boat, but it wasn't right for me. So I went and I started poking around all the other marinas in the south of England, the inland marinas. It's on the River Thames. And I got talking to this one chap called Darren, I think, at Penton Hook on the Thames. And he said, hang on a second, because I asked him what he had. And he said, let me just find out, what do you need to do with the boat? And I said, well, I want to live on it for a while. Then I want to go down the River Thames. I want to cross the channel. And I want to go in through the French waterway system and all the way down to the Mediterranean. And he said, you're looking for the wrong boat. You want a boat with two motors, because when you get to France, having two motors will really increase the maneuverability of the boat. And once you get to the Mediterranean, you want two large motors, because it can get a little bit unpredictable. And if you've got one motor in an old boat and you have a problem, then you will really have a problem. And because, I mean, even once when I was on the boat, I was with a friend of mine, and we were going out to the Red Sands forts, which are these really old Second World War forts that are about, I don't know, 10, 15 K off the coast of Kent. And one of the engines cut out, because I'd never taken the boat very fast, because you can't go more than three or four, probably three knots, really, on the River Thames. And so when I opened it up, what had happened is the bow of the boat had gone higher up, which had caused some water that was probably had collected in the bottom of one of the fuel tanks to get, as the angle of the tank went changed, the level of the water went up past the inlet to the end of the diesel. And so the engine cut out. And I'm like, ah, damn it. But if I'd had one engine, I'd have been in trouble. But because I had two engines, I was able to just slow down, keep going, and get back to port okay. But it would have been, we'd have had to call out the Coast Guard if I'd only had one engine. And so I recommend two engines if you can, to go through the waterways, and especially out here on the water of the Mediterranean.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, exactly. That makes sense. And yeah, it's a good point about having that sort of fail-safe of a second engine. And of course, the maneuverability in the canals is probably quite key. So you started in... is it Calais that's right up the, where you start? And then it's wonderful to just crisscross the whole essentially French countryside, but also large cities like Paris, which seems like you can essentially take your boat to Paris. Like, what?
Imagine that. You can take your boat to Paris. I love Paris. It's a, probably my favorite big city in the world. It's just, it's very elegant. It's very friendly. It's got more culture than just about anywhere else. And it was just great. But I found a marina there, and I sent them the boat details, and they're like, sure, come on. And originally I was only planning on staying in Paris for a week, but it was so nice there. I'm like, well, just stay here longer. And I think it was about 42 euros a night to be in the middle of Paris.
Wow, yeah. You'd paid 400 euros a night in a hotel, easily.
Absolutely. So I just, I made a few friends there. I ended up talking to one girl and shooting a music video for her. You know, it actually paid me to be in Paris, because shooting that one music video covered the cost of staying in that marina the whole time. And she loved the video. It ended up being on French television, and she'd never had a video of one of her songs on French television before. So she was happy, I was happy, and Paris was happy. So it was a great situation.
Yeah, absolutely. What I'm curious about, when you go through the canals, I assume there's a lot of locks that you have to go through. What's that process like? Does that continue to be nerve-wracking? I'm sure it is the first time you do it, but do you get used to it? Is there a system or process to the madness?
Yes, there is a process to the madness. I've been through quite a few. Well, when I say quite a few, I'd probably gone through about 8, maybe 10 locks in my life, because there's locks on the River Thames. And I originally, where I bought the boat, which was Bray, which is near Maidenhead, I had taken the boat upstream a couple of times, just, you know, because I could. And then when I went down, I probably went through, I don't know, 3 or 4 locks. There's a big lock at Teddington and stuff. So I felt pretty experienced at going through locks, because I've done 10 of them. I went through 216 locks to get to the Mediterranean. So I was a lot more experienced by the time I hit the salty water on the other side. It's, you know, there is a trick to doing it right. If you go at them too slowly, then there's not enough water passing over the rudder, so you don't have as much control. But if you go too fast, you're going to create a wake, and you're going to it's going to get silly. So you go in nice and steady, but you know where you're going to go, and you react quickly, and you pay attention, and you slide into the locks. I videoed a lot of them, so you can see that on the YouTube of me getting into places where it's funny because at the beginning, like 2 or 3 minutes before you go into the lock looks tiny, and you're like, how am I? You know, it's like landing an F-18 on an aircraft carrier deck. You know, it's like you see the videos of the pilots doing that, and you're like, you see the aircraft carrier's way in the distance. And you're like, how the hell is he going to land this F-18 on that thing? And then he does, and you're like, oh, you see, it got bigger as you get closer. Science. Going through the first few locks probably felt as nerve-wracking as the first time a Navy pilot drops an F-18 onto an aircraft carrier. He's got a bit more at stake than I do, but it would be equally as embarrassing.
Absolutely. Well, what about the communication with the operators? Is it in French only, or will they do it in English?
Well, quite often there's no operators. You get what they do is when you get into the system, I've forgotten where it was now. The first few always had people at, and if there wasn't someone at the actual lock, you could make a quick phone call to the VNF, and you pay them, it's about 130 something euros a month, and that pays for all the operators, it pays for the maintenance of the locks, and it pays for them to come out and help you if it's needed. But they'll come out and they'll push the buttons, and you see a red light as you approach the lock, and then it goes to red and green, which means they see you and they're working on it. And then when the lock is open and set for you, that goes to a green light and you proceed through the lock. But some of them are remote control. So there's someone operating it, but they're operating it from a control center somewhere else. And what you do is as you approach it, you hit a little button, and there's a sensor about 300 meters short of the lock that picks up the little radio button click thing and sets the whole thing in motion. And they just monitor it and make sure you're not screwing things up from a distance. But it's I had no issues with any of the locks. There was one that wouldn't open properly once we got in. I had a friend of mine with me, and we got into the lock, and it closed, but the other part of it wouldn't open. And all it was the grass had grown up over past the sensor, and it thought that there was something blocking it, so the gate wouldn't move. But he came out, and he just went meep, 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 and cleaned it, and the gate opened, and that was that. But they were all very friendly. They were very polite, very nice, and most of them spoke some English. So it was never a problem.
That sounds way less stressful than I thought it would be. So that is actually really great to hear. And another thing that I'm thinking, I recently chatted with somebody in the US who had done the Great Loop, and they said there were occasionally debris like logs and such in the water, because there's a lot of commercial traffic in the Great Loop waterways. But what about the canals in France? Is there a lot of debris or any sort of challenges aside from the locks, which don't seem to be that much of a challenge, but anything like that?
I checked the weed trap probably once a week or so, and I did have one point at which a twig got into the inlet for the water to cool the engine. And so the weed trap was clear, And I'm like, why is the engine overheating? And it was because a twig had got inside there. And there's an odd, poorly designed thing that's just a 90-degree turn for the inlet pipe. And a twig had gone in there, and that had just eventually blocked everything up. And so it was causing my engine overheat. It took a couple of weeks to figure out exactly what was going on, because if you ran the engine very slowly, it wouldn't overheat. It was only once it ran a bit faster that it was overheating. So I could kind of get away with running it, and then I figured out what it was. And so that was it. The only other mechanical issue I had was my starboard motor controller upstairs slipped its little plastic control thing, had come off and broken. And so I had to super glue that together and put it back on again. But with the help of a friend, I was able to do that and get back on the road quite efficiently.
Yeah, oh, that's great to hear, because in my mind, the French canal system is very quaint and kind of relaxing. And it sounds like a lot of it is, it's not as intimidating as maybe some of the larger waterways. So that's great to hear.
Yeah, I never felt intimidated by it at all. Maybe that's just me being overconfident. I don't know. But I always felt fine. The lowest bridges are just south of Calais. So if you can get 12K south of Calais, you're pretty much going to be okay the whole way through France. Unless they have heavy rains, you then might have to wait a few days for the level to go back down again. The only other thing I had to wait for was there was a canal, a couple of gates of the canal were being replaced when I got there. And it was the low season, and they took about 2 weeks to replace the canal gates. But I found a little marina just back from where I needed to, and I ended up staying there almost a month because it was so nice. And then there was another place in Montargis, which was a really cute little town in the sort of center of France, that had a bridge that was being repaired. And I didn't get under the bridge in time. So I could have done, but I didn't know the bridge was going to be repaired. So when I woke up and decided to move the boat, I was moving it, and I'm like, "Whoa, no, well, this is no good." And so I parked the boat up and got off and walked up to it. And one of the workers explained that it was going to be impassable for a couple of months. So I just went back to my mooring, and someone from the VNF came by and said, "Yeah, the bridge is going to take a few 2 months to fix. It was a scheduled maintenance. Sorry that we hadn't noticed, but we were welcome to use the electricity and the mooring for as long as we wanted until the bridge was open." How nice is that? How nice is that? There are so many little French towns that have free electricity, free water, and a free mooring spot, and a little sign up that says you're welcome to stay here, but please limit it to 3 days. You find that often. You know, it must have been 30 different places that had that.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's very nice. Yeah, that is a very convenient and friendly approach to it. Now, you've gone through France, and then you made your way to the Mediterranean, and actually you've made it quite far, as you're in the sort of southern part of Italy right now. And being in the Mediterranean is obviously much different with being in open water and an entirely different environment. I'm curious, which one appeals to you more? The canal life or the open water?
I really like the canals. If you can do it with a friend, I think it's a lot better. I mean, sailing generally is better if you've got someone else on board, but it's just great. I really like the Mediterranean because it's got to be one of the most boat-friendly places in the world. There's a lot of boats in the south of France and the coastal Italy, and there's just a lot of boats, and people are very friendly, but there's a lot of boats.
Yeah, it's popular for a reason, and that doesn't surprise me at all. Having seen some of your footage from the Mediterranean, I mean, the places there are just gorgeous. It's exactly what you picture Mediterranean to be: beautiful towns, little hills, and historic cities, and beautiful blue water. Like, what's not to love?
Right? Exactly. It's really nice, and the marinas are all super efficient. And in the low season, very, very inexpensive. I mean, you can stay in the middle of Nice for 19 euros a night.
What? Really? Wow.
And that's on a visitor's berth. That's like you could stay there for two nights and you're only getting charged 38 euros. It's just
wow.
So if you stay for a month, you can get an even better deal. But that's a bargain.
Absolutely, especially coming from a little bit of a colder climate where the winter in the Mediterranean is plenty warm enough. Would be amazing.
Yeah. I highly recommend wintering in the Med because it's cheap. Now, the Mediterranean is infamous for having changeable weather. And I got bitten by that, as I was explaining earlier. But if you pay attention to the weather and you make sure you've always got a nice, safe anchorage or marina to go to, then great. And also another thing with the marinas is I wanted to go to Monaco because it's Monaco, right? And so I sent them an email saying, is it okay if I just come there for a couple hours? And they were like, yeah, absolutely. And so I just went there and I tied my boat between these two multi-million dollar super yachts. They just helped me in and I went in and I parked there, tied my boat off and I went. I stayed in Monaco for like 4 hours and there's no charge. They just let you just come in and fill up with water if you need to. I've never been charged for water. And I've never been charged extra for electricity, although I'm told that some places do that in the summer. But right now, there's no one charging me anything for that.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah. Oh, that sounds really great, actually. And again, yeah, very friendly, which is not necessarily the image I had in my head. Talk to me about the Friendly Flag project that you created.
Aha. Yes. I was at this strange place. It's called Île Sainte-Marguerite, and it's just about 5 or 6K south of Cannes. And in the summer, it's a little bit like, the roundabout that goes around the Arc de Triomphe? It's a little bit like that, but for boats. I would estimate that there's 1,200 boats there on a nice Saturday afternoon if the weather's good. So it's crazy popular. And I was talking to a friend of mine and I posted a photograph. I sent a picture to him. It was from a drone. So you could see how many boats were there. And he said, yeah, that looks great. Does anyone talk to anyone else? And I said, no, not really. I mean, they're friendly and people wave at each other, but there doesn't seem to be much interaction between the actual people on the boat. And if you're on a boat, I'm a single guy. It's a little weird of me to just jump in my dinghy and row up to another boat and go, hi. I mean, it's okay to do that, but no one's done it to me. And I don't, it's like, I'd be like, well, who are you, And I'm like, wouldn't it be nice if there was a way of signifying that you welcome people to come up and just say hi? And so I went to sleep that night and just thought about it. And I'm like, there should be a flag, like a friendly flag. I know, I should make a friendly flag. And so I poked around the interwebs the next morning, and I saw a few different flag designs, and I'm like, no. And then I created this design, which is just a pair of hands shaking some like a white and black logo, because it needed to be a logo. It couldn't just be a picture, and it needed to signify friendship, and a handshake seems to do that. It's also the ASL for friendship is a pair of hands shaking. You know, it's like that means friendship. And so I'm like, great. And then I posted that on a Mediterranean sailing Facebook page, and everyone just loved the idea. Far more. I mean, I've posted crazy ideas on Facebook pages before, but this was off the hook. I mean, literally hundreds of people were like, this is great. If you make one, I'll buy one. And I'm like, huh. And so I went on to, I don't know, Alibaba, I think, and found a company in China that said they could print a bunch for me, and they were reasonably priced. I mean, I still had to pay for, you know, the manufacture and the shipping and everything, but it wasn't too bad. And so that's what I did. And I found myself with two very large boxes of 2,000 flags. And, because if I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it properly. And I wanted to be able to give them out a lot, but I wanted to have enough to sell as well. So I've been selling them for, I think it's like 14 euros, which covers my costs. So I've sold enough that my costs are covered, and I, because that makes me feel good, because that means I can, if I give them away, it doesn't feel like I'm giving away money. It feels like I'm giving away friendship. And some marinas have been very, very enthusiastic about it. This marina where I'm at in Gaeta right now, it was quite funny, because when I got there, I was talking to the receptionist, and she said, oh, would you like one of these flags? And I'm like, ah, that's my flag. I did that flag. And she's like, oh, my God. And so because what had happened is some friends of mine had stayed here, and they talked to the girl behind the desk. And she said, oh, that's a great idea. So I got her address, and I mailed her a package of a whole bunch of flags. But I didn't know who she was. It was just a name on an address. And so it was kind of fun to reacquaint myself with her and give her a bunch more flags, because she only had a couple of left. So that was good.
Oh, that sounds like a really great idea.
Yeah. If you type in friendly flag, I think it's friendlyflag.net. Or .com, both. I've got both of them. You will find my flags, and I don't know if you can put a link to it in this podcast as well. And I mean, it's worked. A couple of people, one person was in a marina, and they were walking along, and they saw a friendly flag, and they didn't have a flag, but they knew what it was because I'd posted about it on some Facebook page. And so they said, oh, look, a friendly flag. And then they ended up going out to dinner that night and then cruising together the next day. And I think that's happened a couple of times. And that's the whole point. It's just a little way of making the world just a little bit friendlier. And, you know, it's like we're if you're on a boat, it's a pretty lonesome life anyway. You know, if someone comes close to you on a boat, usually it's because their anchor's dragging.
Exactly.
Or they've fallen asleep or something. It's a bad thing. If some boat comes close to me, I'm going to be out there with a foghorn letting them know. So it's just a way of having people get a little bit closer, but in a good way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the world needs a little bit more of that. And I think it's a great idea to sort of signal that, yeah, welcome chit chat.
A friend of mine runs an RV site in America, and she liked the idea. So she had me send a bunch out to her, and she gives them to the people who come and stay at her RV site, because they can just stick a little friendly flag out. Because again, it's a little bit like being in a marina. You don't want to just walk up to people and go, "Hi, I'm your new friend." You know, it's just like, but if you put the flag up when you want to talk to someone, I don't know if it'll work. But if I keep pushing it, I think after a couple of sailing seasons here, it could catch on.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that is a fantastic idea. And it sounds like it's already taken off and it is working. So I look forward to seeing where that goes. And yes, I can include links, and I will include the links in the description here as well, for the friendly flag, as well as your YouTube channel, so that people can go find that in the online world and follow your adventure along, because you've got exciting plans to head even further south.
Learn from my mistakes instead of your own.
Exactly. Seriously. That's great.
I've made many. Actually, I kind of like that. That would be a good little tagline. Learn from my mistakes instead of your own. I think that's a good one. I like that. God, I'm a genius.
That is a great one. You better write it down now, put it on a YouTube header or something.
I'll forget about it, and then one day I'll listen to this podcast and I'll be like, oh yeah, that was a good idea. I should do that.
Exactly. Fantastic. Well, Steve, thank you so much for sharing a little bit about your experiences and your projects and all that fun stuff. It was really great to chat with you.
My pleasure. I strongly recommend people you don't have to buy a boat and all go to extremes, but just travel, adventure, do more stuff, because I don't think anyone was on their deathbed thinking, oh, I wish I hadn't traveled so much. You know, it's travel is good for you. There would be far fewer problems if more people traveled, because you find that people are actually quite friendly and quite nice out there. It doesn't matter where they come from or who they are. They're just, people are friendly. And it's a good way of reminding yourself about that. So I recommend you do it.
Absolutely.
But it's like people, I couldn't do it because I got grandchildren, you know. No, your grandchildren don't care. The grandchildren would rather have a place to come and visit than have you live in 20 miles away. You know, it's just like, no, stop throwing excuses out and just get on with it. Or don't, you know, it's like not everyone can do it, but if you can, go for it.
That's all for this week's episode of the Liverbird Sailing Podcast. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed recording it. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast and leave a little review on your favorite podcast platform. I would also encourage you to check out Steve's YouTube channel and the Friendly Flag project, both of which I've linked into the show notes. Until next time, bye for now.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time.
That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.